NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Flight Safety Detectives. Myself, Todd Curtis, and of course, John Golia and Greg Fife, and today's special guest, Mark Dumbroff from Fox Rothschild LLP, professional law firm. Glad to have you with us today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here, Todd.
One of the things that we wanted to talk about on this show today that I think is very timely is, of course, the fact that Boeing is, again, in the spotlight. The face of Boeing, David Calhoun, was up on the Hill testifying. And of course, there was a 204-page report that was produced just prior to his testimony outlining whistleblower comments, statements, depositions regarding some of the things that were going on at Boeing, that they've hid parts that may not have been approved from the FAA and a variety of other things. This is just to add on top of all of the issues regarding the 737 MAX and even the 787 now. It also included Spirit AeroSystems, which provides tubes and other parts for Boeing. The big question now, with all of the talk that's going on in the industry, is criminalization. We know that through the news media, there's been a lot of reports that the DOT and, of course, the NTSB and the FAA, everybody's conducting an investigation. But the word criminalization is what stands out to those of us in the safety industry, especially here in the United States with the NTSB, because it could have a dramatic, if not a devastating effect on aviation safety and how aircraft accidents and incidents are investigated here in the United States. Mark, you've been in the business as a litigator for better than four decades. You've worked for airlines, you've worked on behalf of manufacturers, you've been on both sides of the fence, you were at the DOJ, you were at the FAA in the legal offices. What does this mean to you when you start hearing criminalization with Boeing and what it's going to do to aviation here in the States?
I don't think really it has any particular, if you will, focus vis-a-vis any single company. I think historically, if one looks back, the United States, we've simply not criminalized aviation accidents. And I believe that that's been done for good reason. And the net result of that is we have the safest aviation system in the world in this country. I think the reason for that is that there's such total disclosure and cooperation in the accident investigation process. If you reduce it to its most simplistic level, and if members of the airline industry, the aviation industry in general, feel that there's a risk of criminal prosecution, quite frankly, the people within the company that may be involved are not going to talk to the investigators. And I think that has been perceived as a very real concern and a very legitimate concern. And I think it's one of the reasons that the NTSB is viewed, and I happen to agree, as the platinum standard on aviation accident investigation throughout the world. Outside the United States, that's not true in terms of criminalization. Probably one of the most classic examples, Greg, recently is the Gol midair down in South America, in Brazil, where the pilots of the XLR aircraft were indicted. They were held in Brazil for a number of months. They were finally released. And I think it was within the past 30 days that the Brazilian government has essentially abandoned the prosecution. And I think their stated reason is that the U.S. government has not cooperated with them. As I recall, the air traffic control system in Brazil is run by the military. And the Brazilian Accident Investigation Authority essentially cleared the military, which is not a surprise. And they chose to blame it on the U.S. pilots down there. It's tragedy, the accident, obviously, over 100 people perish. But the fact is, criminalization really created a major problem. And it's not unique to countries like Brazil. It's very common outside the United States. I think what's happening right now is, following the Lion Air accident, the Ethiopian Airlines accident, neither of which were led in the investigation by the National Transportation Safety Board, since ICAO Annex 13 was the operative law in terms of determining who the state of state or country of investigating authority would be. The families there, and they were virtually all non-U.S. citizens, which really is just a point of observation as opposed to anything else, really came out very strongly after the Justice Department entered into a deferred prosecution agreement regarding those two accidents. And the basis upon which they came out, and here's the nub of the issue going forward, was the Crime Victims' Rights Act. It's U.S. legislation, and it really prescribes, in the case of crime victims, what their rights are with respect to the prosecution. And it includes, as one of the provisions, the right to be informed in a timely manner of any plea bargain or deferred prosecution agreement. And once the deferred prosecution agreement was entered into by the Department of Justice and approved by the court in Texas, the families of the victims in those two accidents took strong exception to the fact that they were crime victims and they had a right to be conferred with prior to the deferred prosecution agreement. As I recall, that went to the court in Texas, and the court upheld the deferred prosecution agreement or its effectiveness. Now, since that time, the Department of Justice has indicated their conclusion that Boeing has not complied with the terms of the deferred prosecution agreement, and they have until early July, the first week in July, to decide what they're going to do, Department of Justice is going to do. I think the concern that I see is whether or not future victims of aviation accidents, and it doesn't have to be an airline, it's a highly regulated industry, a federally regulated industry, as we all know, whether or not they're going to somehow see this as an ability to pick up the torch and start to seek criminal prosecution, whether it's of pilots, mechanics, airlines, manufacturers, and really start to make a public outcry following an accident, that there should be a criminal prosecution. And if that picks up any momentum, I think that we're going to have some real problems in terms of our accident investigation universe and the role that the NTSB plays.
Didn't this discussion take place several years ago? Wasn't there something floating around about criminalization? And again, it was, you know, discussed amongst the industry, and there was a lot of discussion about how it would inhibit or degrade aviation safety, because we wouldn't have this ability to get free-flowing information during the course of an investigation from all of the parties involved, if you will. And now it seems to be more realistic because of, you know, what's taken place. And you made a comment about the industry and, you know, with the FAA and Boeing and all of the, at least the allegations that have been made. These are, I mean, pretty serious charges that have been levied, do you really think that they would carry forward? Have they really thought this through as to how it's going to inhibit us going forward?
Have they really thought it through? Who knows? I really don't know, but you're absolutely right. Over the past, 10, 15, 20 years, maybe more, periodically, this issue of criminalization comes up. And by the way, it's not limited to the companies, whether it's the airlines and the manufacturers. It includes the air traffic controllers. I think if you all are familiar generally, I can't give you a specific one, but there have been air traffic controllers in other countries that have been criminally prosecuted by their governments, by the prosecutors in those countries. I think that what we are doing, or what will be happening, is really undermining an incredible system that we have developed in this country. Now, let me say something. If there's, there are criminal prosecutions and I've seen a number of them. I've been involved in some of the fact circumstances underlying them, where documents are signed that shouldn't have been signed. They're federal documents, and there are penalties, and it's the same sort of penalties. If you look at the, I don't know whether it's on the income tax returns, the 1040, but in the little print at the bottom, there are federal penalties for signing things that are not true. Well, that's one thing. But when you start moving into the realm of the kinds of things we're talking about, I'm not going to say there aren't fact patterns that don't justify a look vis-a-vis criminal law and criminal violations. But I'm concerned that plaintiff's lawyers are going to see this as a torch that they can pick up, or a drumstick they can pick up and beat the drum. And whether it's a corporate aircraft, whether it's an airline aircraft, whatever it may be, and try to engage the Department of Justice in looking at it. And we all know that after an aviation accident, and I tell all my clients, after an aviation accident, there's some prosecutor out there looking at it. But in our country, we don't criminalize aviation accidents. And I think that's a good thing.
Well, let me ask you something specifically about what you just said about other countries with air traffic controllers. Here in the States, you have two kinds of control towers that I'm aware of, one that's staffed by government personnel and ones that are contractor personnel. And I'm no lawyer, but it seems that any kind of contracted air traffic controller might be especially at risk of being subject to criminal prosecution if things change around here.
I'm not sure that they sort of have a special risk, Todd. And the reason I say that is the contract tower program of the FAA, other than the fact that it's run by a contractor, all of the procedures, the programs, the training, the entire process is essentially the same as if it was an FAA-operated tower. So I don't know that they have any greater risk, but the fact is it simply makes the pool of people at risk larger. So it would be air traffic controllers generally. This would not be, none of this would be good if it develops any further. None of it would be good.
Yeah, there was an accident, if you recall. It was a MD-80 that took out a Cessna Citation that had crossed the runway in Italy in the fog. And there was, the airplane ended up sliding into the terminal, and I know that the air traffic controllers, a couple of them went to jail, as well as the airport manager, because of criminal negligence and that kind of thing. When we look at this kind of information, in especially the legal vein, Mark, do you think it would inhibit the flow of information? Because,
yes,
of course, the board's mission is to get as much information as soon as it can, not only to eventually determine a probable cause and safety recommendations at some point, but if there is an immediate change that must be made to enhance safety, that sounds to me like it'll become inhibited because nobody's going to bring forth that information that's necessary to prompt change now versus 2 years from now or 4 years from now.
Well, I think that's exactly right. I think one of the pillars of the level of safety that we have accomplished in this country in our aviation system is essentially voluntary disclosure, non-retaliatory, voluntary disclosure. We've got all sorts of systems in place through the FAA. You have ASAP systems, we have hotline systems, we have all sorts of things. And I think in no small measure, that accounts for the level of safety that we've achieved. The last catastrophic airline disaster in this country, and I'm talking about a true catastrophic disaster, was in 2009. And that was the Colgan accident, the Continental 3407 accident up in Buffalo. It's not an accident that we haven't had an accident in 15 years. It's a function of the fact that we have the kind of system we have, that we have a voluntary free flow, non-retaliatory flow of information, that we've got mounds of information, and we're even better at analyzing and applying the lessons of that information. And one of the tenets, I think, of the SMS systems is, in fact, the free flow of information. And I think the problem is, once people from whom that information would otherwise present it realize or believe that they may be at risk by way of a criminal prosecution, all of a sudden the Fifth Amendment kicks in.
Yeah.
And people are going to start saying, I'm not going to respond. I'm not going to be subject to an interview based upon my Fifth Amendment rights. And there's nothing that the NTSB can do about it at that point. The NTSB can't grant criminal immunity from prosecution. Only the Department of Justice can. And this isn't really necessarily limited to the Department of Justice, at the federal level, you may have state authorities, state criminal authorities, perhaps bringing some sort of cause of action. Their cause of action would not be necessarily for violation of federal regulations, the FARs or federal statutes, but it could be for violation of state law, asserting that an assault and battery was committed on the individual involved in the accident or whatever, the victim. So I think there's a Pandora's box there, and I hope we're not opening it.
Well, on a very narrow point of view, specifically what we do here at Flight Safety Detectives, a lot of what we do, especially with U.S. accidents and incidents, is we cull the data. We look at the NTSB reports. We looked at the public docket. We looked at all sorts of things that the government freely puts out there where we don't have to do a Freedom of Information Act. It's just there for the taking. Would you see this spigot being cut off, or even data being removed from public view from the NTSB and FAA if this trend continues?
Let me put it this way. I've been doing this an awfully long time, and I cannot think of anything in which I've been involved, and I probably can't think of everything that I've been involved in that would justify a criminal prosecution. Mm-hmm. The assertions, obviously, in civil litigation are negligence, even gross negligence. I've tried airline disaster cases to jury verdict where the reason we couldn't get them settled was that the plaintiffs wanted punitive damages, alleging conduct that justified punitive damages. I'm just trying to think of any case in which, I can't think of an airline case in which punitive damages was awarded. There's one I'm aware of, but it was reversed. The only criminal prosecution, one that stands out in my mind has to do with ValueJet, decades ago. I mean, we're all familiar with that. And that had to do with the mislabeling of the oxygen cylinders put on the airplane. And the federal prosecution, as I recall, never went forward. The state prosecution, I may have this backwards, I think the state prosecution went forward. But nobody wants an accident to happen. Nobody. It doesn't matter whether it's the manufacturer or it's the operator or the air trap. Nobody wants an accident to happen. And to somehow start to criminalize conduct, no, I'm sorry. I have a real problem with that.
Hey, Mark, you bring up a point about, criminalization of conduct. Of course, there's been a lot of talk with the FAA early on, right after the MAX accidents, about the so-called love-in between the FAA and Boeing, that, Boeing was self-certifying, the FAA had fallen down on the job, they weren't really doing their oversight function. when you look at that in the grand scheme of things, or even Boeing or some other manufacturer, whose conduct is held accountable? Well, and then who's the one that pays the price? The CEO, the administrator of the FAA, or some of the lower level function management who was directly responsible for a certification oversight or something like that?
Well, here's the reality of that situation. The FAA has, as large an organization as they are, and most of their organization are air traffic controllers, they're just a tiny piece of the overall industry that they regulate. The reality is that they could never accomplish the kind of oversight that people criticize that they are not accomplishing. And it doesn't matter whether it's aviation medical examiners, who are doctors that when they conduct an aviation physical, they're wearing their FAA aviation medical examiner hat, whether it's mechanics who have inspection authorization. And at the time they conduct inspections, they may be wearing their FAA hat. DERs, designated engineering representatives, who are acting on behalf of the administrator. Check airmen who are acting on behalf of the administrator for certain kinds of rides.
Yeah.
The fact is, aviation designees and all elements of the aviation industry are common, and they're the only way that the government, that the FAA, and for that matter, foreign governments can do business. But the fact also is that every time this issue comes up, whether it's inspection authorization or whatever, it's going to get attacked. And I think the amount of money that it would take Congress to give to the FAA in order to take all of this back in-house simply is unrealistically off the charts. Now, does it mean that the system can't always be improved? Hell yeah, the system can always be improved. Better oversight can always be presented. You know, the one thing about aviation safety is I've certainly heard this from every safety professional, including you guys, that you never achieve, you never achieve perfection, because once you believe you've achieved perfection, that's when the accident occurs.
Yeah.
So it's something you are constantly striving for, and hopefully you're constantly getting better and better and better. But you're never going to, and once that mindset arrives in your head that we've gotten there, we're there, that's the point at which everything is going to, frankly, go to hell. So I think that we've got the right philosophy in this country. And honestly, look, I started my career at the FAA, and here I am decades later, and I am a major cheerleader of the FAA. It doesn't mean they're perfect, and it doesn't mean they're striving. They're not striving to get better. They are.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the criticism directed at them and at the industry is just not fair. It's opportunistic, and it's just not fair.
I would agree with you because, again, I mean, these are not problems that are just unique to a Boeing. I mean, now the question is, let's say an Airbus airplane crashes here. And the investigation starts to find similar type issues with a foreign manufacturer. Are they going to be able to prosecute them?
Well, the answer is I don't know the answer. And I'm not sure anybody knows the answer until it happens, if and when it happens. But I think what's happened is the whole concept of criminalization, prosecution in the world of aviation has become, I don't know, I hesitate to say, it's been more socialized the last couple of years. It's been more out there, and it's become, you know, sort of just part of the story. I don't think that's good. I think the investigation process will suffer if criminalization becomes not the norm, but more of the norm. And you guys remember, you know, TWA 800 and the tug of war, that came between the FBI and the NTSB.
Yep.
And the NTSB, you know, tried to investigate and the FBI wouldn't let go. And it just really became a very exasperating exercise for the investigators versus the criminal side of the house. And as I recall it, resulted in an agreement between the NTSB and the FBI with respect to where the lines are. And And I think that's worked out pretty well so far.
Now, you mentioned the socialization of this in the last few years. I'd like to take you back to what you just mentioned, Flight 800, which was 1996, 28 years ago. In my opinion, that was the first of the great online internet plane crashes, in that not only was it just on the evening news of the New York Times and Washington Post, it was everywhere, including, let's just say, conspiracy theories. I'll just leave them at that.
Yeah.
And that has become the norm. Now, I don't think it's amped up much more in the last few years. I think it's been a steady increase since then, when it became possible for people like us to have literally a global platform to bring issues to the forefront. Now, we like to think we're responsible in doing that and we're insiders, but anybody who has, you know, internet access can have an opinion and maybe have an audience, and sometimes the audience can be led astray. How is that making this whole process more difficult?
Well, I remember once I went over to the NTSB, and I recall they had the reception desk. When you got outside the elevators and to the left, they had their operations center. And their source of news, and maybe I'm dating myself, was three or five television sets that were all operating at the same time. And the way they would learn of an accident more often than not was it was on the news. Well, now, you know, we all learn of the accidents same time. We all get the alerts on our phones, and we all know that the event has occurred. I think what's happened, it has allowed people, and you can include whomever you want under that umbrella, to get out there immediately, very quickly, very widespread, very pervasive, with whatever position they want to take. And it gets bounced and rebounced, I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with that. I'm just concerned when people get too far out in front.
Yeah.
You know, aviation accidents are complex at best. And I think the NTSB is fond of saying, and I agree with them, that there's no single cause. It's a confluence of events, typically. Now, they come out with the probable cause and they come out with contributing causes. I think once the criminalization element enters the picture, I think it compromises the system.
How bad do you think it might get for reason conversation, reason discussion about this, if we have events like what happened a few days ago, where Dr. Fauci, of course, famous for being a public health professional, was roasted over the coals, in my opinion, highly unfairly, in what appears to be an attempt by certain politicians to get FaceTime on television, which they were very successful at doing so. But at the same time, saying all sorts of things and giving all sorts of impressions that completely go against the dedication and professionalism, in this case, of Dr. Fauci. But that could be turned on aviation just as easily, in my opinion.
Look, I think the problem is, in some respects, we're already seeing some of it. Everybody's a broadcaster. Everybody's a journalist. We've seen this with the unruly passengers on airplanes and all the videos. And those videos land on your iPhone before the airplane lands on the ground sometimes.
Yeah.
Because people are, you know, transmitting them while they're still in the air. It's we're living in a different world, the communications. Most of it's good. Overwhelming portion of it's good. Some of it ain't so good. And what I'm concerned about is that the extraordinary safety record, which in large measure is contributed to by, you know, the cooperation of the industry with all the various segments, whether it's the airlines, the operators, the manufacturers, the airports, everybody, there are going to be segments or people, individuals in certain kinds of events that are going to look at it and start to get concerned. Think about the unions. The unions are always very, very protective. And John knows this, given his background. The unions are very, very protective of their members. And if one of the unions in the aviation industry feels that their member who was involved, when I say involved, in some way in an accident, or the circumstances giving rise to an accident, could be at risk, what are they going to tell their union member? You know, go ahead and talk to the investigators. I don't know.
Mark, we and Greg, we've seen part of that the consequences of that in ValueJet. You mentioned ValueJet a little while ago, but because of the prosecution that was swirling around that event, we had a number of mechanics on that from that facility refuse to come to the hearings and testify. We had lots of problems in extracting the truthful information, teasing it out of other sources other than those mechanics that were on the floor. Took a lot of work on Greg and his team's part to get that information out.
Yeah.
Wasn't easy. It was
well, fun. Look, I hope, guys, I hope that this never comes to pass.
Yeah.
But I think that there's all sorts of agendas out there. And Todd, you referenced politics, the Senate, the House, there's all sorts of agendas. There's all sorts of public platforms available to people. There are lawyers who view the kind of thing we're talking about as a positive development, criminal prosecution. On I think in part, maybe they're, you know, public, they believe that it does a public service, but they all have clients, and I think it's more a function of benefiting their clients. But I hope it doesn't occur. I genuinely hope it doesn't occur. And Mark, that what we're seeing is not going to become more the norm.
Mark, a couple of questions real quick. One, if this were to come to fruition, how would it then affect insurance? And because, of course, you know, there's a lot of big money with the insurance and these carriers, you know, not here, not only here, but worldwide. How does that affect possibly insurance? And then the second question I have is with the families that were sitting at that hearing who want somebody's head to roll, they want to know that somebody is not only accountable, but they're going to pay some price for the, you know, the destruction of their family because of the loss of a loved one. How, if it doesn't happen, how do you get those people to understand that, yes, they're not going to jail, but, you know, we have taken all the actions we can take. We're right. Holding them accountable. You should be satisfied with that.
I think what you've just described is the way it's been. The NTSB is very effective, in my view, at holding people accountable. You go back and look at a number of the accident reports for accidents, and they're pretty straight arrow in the language they use. I don't really see much in the way of pussyfooting around, calling it as they see it. So one, you have accountability there. Two, you have a civil litigation system. I've certainly seen no reluctance over the past decades of people to avail themselves of that civil litigation system. I think, you know, at the end of the day, I'm not sure what criminal accountability, and I don't, again, I have not seen a case, in terms of catastrophic disasters, airline disasters, and I'm not necessarily familiar enough with some of the stuff that's going on there right now, although I have some involvement in it, by way of the facts that would rise to the level of criminal conduct. I remember an airline accident a number of years ago that I took to trial because the plaintiffs wanted punitive damages. And the standard for punitive damages was gross willful negligence. Willful, it's intentional. With reckless disregard of the consequences. Now, at what point do you step over the line between, you know, punitive conduct and criminal conduct? I'm not sure about that. I think that line is pretty gray. And I remember telling the jury that the plaintiffs are suggesting to you that this captain willfully, intentionally, with reckless disregard of the safety of these passengers, did what he did. Basically, he had an intent to crash that airplane and kill himself. He had a family at home. He has kids at home. He no more wanted to crash that airplane than anybody else in that airplane wanted it to crash. And the fact, I've never had a jury find the existence of the basis for punitive damages. And I honestly, that's not to say that maybe sometime in the future there won't be.
Yeah.
But I just don't see these developments as healthy developments. for passengers and those affected by aviation accidents to be characterizing themselves and as crime victims. I'm sorry, that to me is a pretty big hurdle, and I just don't see it as a healthy development in the safety that we've accomplished in this system.
Do you think the industry should be sitting basically in a holding pattern, waiting to see the outcome, or do you see the airline industry and, of course, the aviation industry, you know, having roundtable discussion about, well, we probably need to start working on something?
Well, I think you know, my advice to clients would probably be aware of this occurring out there and what's happening out there. And in terms of your own internal governance and your own processes and procedures and programs and training and so forth, you know, recognize where somebody may want to try to take it. You need to have really, in order to really enter the realm of criminal prosecution, you have to have a willing Department of Justice. Let's just talk about the federal level. Prosecutors who are willing to prosecute. And I think that the NTSB certainly, I'm sure, has been having discussions, but I'm sure they're not going to throw themselves into the middle of that whole controversy. And I get it. Yeah. Their mandate is to investigate aviation accidents. And it's just going to be very difficult if we veer off into this path with any regularity.
Do you see, especially because a lot of our audience is general aviation, if this were to come to fruition, do you see it trickling down into general aviation? And what does that mean for me as an aircraft owner and a private pilot?
I guess I could come up with some hypotheticals, you know, and we've seen them. All of us are familiar with the GA aircraft that takes off and the guy leaves a note for his family or you know, we've had a couple circumstances where the airplane is taken and it's crashed and the person dies. Yeah. People, they look at it. It's been determined that there are the mental issues involved it's an intentional suicide. Now that would perhaps by definition include mental issues. But think about it in terms of, you know, who are the other players in that? The owner of the airplane who gave access to the person to fly it, the FBO that had custody of the airplane and somehow it got away from them, or, you know, whatever. And so far, you know, knock on wood, we're fortunate that those airplanes have not hit any houses, have not hit any downtown areas, have not hit any innocent bystanders. But yeah, are there possibilities? Heck yeah. You can even talk about corporate airplanes. You know, while, you know, you're going to have both employees on the corporate aircraft as well as perhaps non-employees on the corporate aircraft. It just introduces another dimension that I would say in the overwhelming majority of circumstances has no place in the aviation universe. And I hope it stays that way.
Yeah, no, I agree. Well, John, Todd, any last minute questions for Mr. Dombroth?
Well, last minute questions, no, but last minute comments, yes. As many of you know, I typically do the second to the last word. And my second to last word is that if it seems that we're very engaged in this and almost emotional about this subject, it's because these are issues which we think go to the heart of what makes the system, what you described earlier, as a platinum standard for the NTSB. They are the way they are because of what's been done all this time. I'm of the opinion, an engineering approach, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So that's my second to last word.
By the way, let me add one thing, and maybe it'll be the third to last word. I don't think, and again, I attribute the best of motives to members of the aviation industry, and I don't care whether they're manufacturers, operators, airports, whomever. They want the safest system that is possibly achievable out there. And as I've told juries, I said, the reason that an airline wants to be as safe as it could possibly be and try to keep getting safer and safer is because it's good business. Yeah. It is just good business. And accidents do happen, but they're accidents. They're accidents. And I think we can't lose sight of that.
Yeah, I agree with you. And before I leave you with the last word, John, let me just say that at least John and I have had the honor to known Mark for quite a long time. And he has always been a wealth of information, and that's why we like to have him on the show to provide us this perspective. You can, of course, see him on TV as one of the talking heads when there's some sort of, event. But he joins the rest of us where he sticks to the facts and gives, very basic factual basis for the comments that he makes, because he talks from experience. He also holds an airline symposium, usually in February, where he brings together a lot of people and discusses these relevant issues. And I think that right now, your perspective, Mark, and I greatly appreciate it, is based on what's going on. You've had an opportunity to review some of that 204-page report and see the whistleblower comments, which are very stabbing to Boeing. Now, whether they all pan out and are used for or against them, that's to be determined. But we appreciate you being in the industry with your opinion. You've always been a valuable resource, and I think that anybody watching this should follow you through Fox Rothschild or whatever else as far as a medium is concerned, because you are a wealth of knowledge. So we appreciate you being on the show. With
Thank
that,
you.
John, I'm going to leave you with the last word.
Well, I have two words this time. Mark, I remember it's like something like 34 or 35 years ago when I first interfaced with you as a result of an accident. And you were a lot younger then. You didn't have all this smush on your face either.
That's all accurate. Unfortunately, all of it's accurate.
Yes.
I still, well, the I don't know that all of your audience knows this about John, but John, what you started out on the ramp at Washington National Airport, am I, or at Boston Logan Airport,
A lot of
and
airports in my life.
that's when I first met John, and he's right, it was 35 plus years ago.
Yes, long time. And you're still the same guy, straight shooter. So, to all our audience, I think this was a great eye-opener for a show. But all of you that are out there that want to fly need to keep your eyes open. If you're going to go flying, do a good session of pre-planning before you go to the airport. Do it again at the airport. And if they don't agree, then really sharpen your pencil and take a look at what you've done. When you get out to your airplane, do a good pre-flight. I still see people that don't touch their airplane doing pre-flights, general aviation airplanes. They don't touch their airplane. Touch your airplane. That helps your eyes focus on the area that you're looking at. After you get in your airplane, make sure you do a good pre-flight inside the airplane. And when you take off, put that head on a swivel because we're still having accidents involving mid-airs and near mid-air collisions all around. We have a lot of student pilots flying out there, and you don't want to be part of their accident. So put your head on the swivel and pay attention. What's going on around you? Situational awareness is still critical flying. And I know, Todd, you never put your head on a swivel. It's usually somewhere else.
Especially when I'm flying. At least I feel that way.
My shots in because they get me with my age all the time. Please, please fly safely.
Thank you for checking out our show. We really value our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you and how much you like it. So please give us 5 stars in your podcast platform.
We want to keep in contact with you. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're on YouTube, we're really working on growing the channel, and it helps if you all send in comments. Please do that, and we read all the comments.
And be sure to subscribe. Remember, if you're in the market for aviation insurance, you can save 5% with Avemco just by mentioning our show. Visit them at www.avemco.com. That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detective.
Until the next episode, fly safe.